than German is. Okay, so English, the older form, the Germans were using the word pipe, or something, you know, different dialects spelled it slightly differently. But they shifted this P to a PF, because that's the Aramaic influence. And after vowels, they shifted P to an F after vowels. So this P goes to an F. And the word for German, in German for pipe is Pfeife. You can see some other example here. Pepper going to Pfeffer. Pound going to Pfund. Okay. So English representing the older language. And German representing the new language. Influenced by whom? Christianized Jews. Hitler insisted on it. Look what they did to the T. The T they shifted to a TS sound, written Z. This is the ones from Venice, the Christianized Jews from the originally from Rome and went up to Venice. Now then they went up to the Italian Alps, then they came into Germany. Okay? And after vowels, a T goes to S. So we've got at the first of the word 10, the T goes to a Z, okay, it's written Z, but it's pronounced ts, like that, TS. Halfway between a T and an S. Same. That's German saying. Water goes to Wasser. That's after vowels. T goes to S after vowels. Water to Wasser. White to Weiss. And there are, you know, many, many, many examples. All the S's in German come from T's in English. Look at the K. K goes to CH. So we have make with a K, macha in German with a CH. And cake goes to Kuchen. K goes to CH. A little bit of this influence happened in English at the first of words. We got comma going to chamber, CH. So it happened in English, but the problem is England was quite heavily populated. A lot of Jews went into England. Okay, a lot of the Christianized Jews went to England. But the influence on the language was vocabulary only. We had lots of vocabulary. I have hundreds of vocabularies. But it did not change. This T, you know, did not go to S in English because we have a few examples. Road went to rose. You know, our word rose has an S in it. Okay, there's an example. There's some examples. But in German, it was overwhelming, you know, the influence on the sound shift. But in English, it's mostly vocabulary. We had too many people live in England to be affected that much by the Jews. Question?
High German, is that German?
Today, High German means proper German. But originally, High German meant High South German spoken up in the High Alps. Okay, coming in from the south. North German, the flat German, was called Plattdeutsch. Platt means flat or low. Low meaning low country, not low level of language. Although today it's kind of changed the meaning. Plattdeutsch is not accepted and High German is accepted as the standard German. English broke off of Plattdeutsch, low German, low North German, not that it was a worse German. But, of course, the Germans today, since they speak High German, it's the only proper German now, you know. And so they think of us as being low German speakers. Good question. Any other clarification, things like that? Okay, here it is, D. Now, D, at the first of words, in all the sound changes, D shifted to T, and B shifted to P. Okay, B, D, G shifted to P, T, K. So here it happens again, D at the first of words shifted to T. So we get door going to tour. Do going to two, hundreds of examples of that. But look, TH does not belong at the first of words in Hebrew. The D and the T only shift to TH after vowels normally. So when these Jewish speakers, Christianized Jews came in, they see a TH in English, like in the word this, and they say, it doesn't belong. It's got to be a D. So they shift it to a D, so they get das. This goes to das. Think goes to dink. That goes to das. Because, see, the TH goes to D. TH goes to D. And what does T do? We come up here. T after vowels goes to S. So we got an S on the end of das. Means that. Okay. A little example of what happens with the Christianized Jews and how we prove it. We prove it with those sound shifts, and then we find in the German language thousands of Hebrew words. Pretty close to being as high as English, 90%. Okay, that takes care of the four sound shifts. So we can take a break now for 10 minutes of questions, and then I think we're going to have a little intermediate presentation, and then we're going to talk about I'm going to sort of summarize all of the migrations and other things. We'll mix in a few legends, cultural influences, and things that are a little easier to understand without knowing the linguistics, and as well as answer some more questions. Okay, question.
In the story of Jonah, we're told how he disobeyed God and wanted to go the opposite direction.
Jonah went to Nineveh. I'm just going to repeat so you can all hear.
In the story of the Old Testament, it talks about Jonah having two daughters, Sarah and Pharaoh. In one of your previous maps of Europe, especially concerning Spain, you had an old town called Zaragoza. Originally spelled Z-A-R-A-H-G-O-S-A. It's now S-A-R-A.
I'm going to talk about that next hour, so, yeah.
Is it possible, in your opinion, that Jonah was really trying to get some of the people of Zara, the descendants of Zara,
That's interesting. We also know that Solomon had a colony of Israelites living in Spain. He collected taxes from them and things like that, you know. So it could be that colony. It could go back to Zaragoza. It's hard to know. Yeah, but he could have been trying to flee to some other Israelite community. That's very possible. And I think they were much more aware of the other Israelites spread throughout the Mediterranean than what we give them credit for. I think they knew Phoenicians were a mixture of Israelites. Yeah. I don't know if I'll get into that or not, but yeah. The Phoenicians were a nobody until they were conquered by Israelites, and then they became a great sea maritime people. Yeah. Question? In China? White mummies, right? Yeah. Anciently there was a silk, called the Silk Road, okay, the route into the east. Now, I haven't talked too much about the Israelites that migrated eastward, and some of them did. They went along that Silk Road, and they settled in what we today call southeastern Russia, like Uzbekistan and states like that. They have legends there that they're Israelites, you know. Yes, I believe so, and I believe some of those could have made it as far east as those mummies. And whether those mummies were speaking Tocharian or not, the scholars identify one group of these people who went over there. They found two documents written in a language which looks very much like the other European languages. And whether or not they spoke that language or not, I'm not sure. But yes, I believe they very well could have been. And so, yeah. Now, about the eastward migrations, the Israelites were held captive, you remember, in a city called Gozan. And G shifts to what? K, which makes it Kozan. Kozan. And K shifts to what? CH, Chosen. Chosen is the word for Korea, you know. And there are some taller, somewhat slightly lighter Koreans, and then there are darker Koreans, you know. North and South, it's probably the North-South-West. You know, war. The Israelites versus the non-Israelites there. Yeah, so, and then I told you this morning tonight about the cave they found in Japan, right? So, yeah, there's evidence of Israelites. Sometimes Israelites go and they're in the minority. And I'll find 10 to 20 to 30% Hebrew. They're predominantly non-Israelites, but they've definitely received some Israelite influence. Other times Israelites migrate and they end up in the majority, with 80, 90% Hebrew and 10 to 20% non-Israelite in blood and in language. So, yeah, so just because there's some Hebrew influence doesn't mean they're all Israelites, but yes, that's a good example, I think, of a contingent. And then there are books out now about the Chinese influence. You know, they found some ceremonies in China that they can't explain. They're identical to the Old Testament, you know, the Feast of Tabernacles and things like that. In China, is just kind of interesting, you know. So I think there was. I think they not only went there, I think they were influential there for a little while, at least, you know.
You mentioned Latvian language similar to Latin. I haven't heard anything mentioned between the Latvian language and Latin.
I haven't mentioned that in this meeting, huh?
No. Now, where is the originally coming from Latvia, if you don't see anything in words, you may shout it, now Latvian words.
Just for you, I'm going to have to add all the Latvian and Lithuanian and Lydian and Latin. See, I've got Latin in there. Did you see any similarities between Latvian and Latin?
No, I've never seen Latin on it.
Okay, I'll do a little study for you and send that to you and add it to my lectures so that we can... Generally, not that many people are interested in Latvian, so you know I haven't put it on here, but I think I should put that on there because it's important.
Yeah. Also, you mentioned Lithuanian similarity. Mm-hmm. Very, very few words would be similar to each language. I would not understand Lithuanian if I speak it.
Let's just take the word Lydia by itself. How is a D pronounced in the 700 BC migration? D is pronounced like? TH. In the 1500 BC migration, it would be a T, right? And that's why Latvian does not shift. Latvian still has a T. But in Lithuanian, some 700 BC Israelites came in, pronounced that D as a TH, and came up with Lithuania out of Lydia. That's where they came from, Lydia, ancient country of Lydia. Anciently, the country of Lydia early was called Lod, L-A-D. And that D shifts to T and we get Latvia and Latin. But later, the Lydia itself changes to Lydia. Instead of Lod, they cannot call it Lydia. But it's actually Lydia, you know, it's actually Lydia. It's actually, that D is actually pronounced as TH because it's got Hebrew influence in there. And I've studied when it was that the Israelites went in there. When these people, the Israelites went in and founded Troy, the Lydians asked them, you know, please help us here, you know, protect us from some evil people, you know. And so they did, and they built a new city called Sardis. And that was a Israelite capital of Lydia. And so, yeah, and they changed the name from Lod to Lydia, which we write as Lydia, and it goes up to Lithuania as TH. Yeah.
Is it possible to identify the modern-day Assyrians? Who would they be today?
Modern-day Assyrians. Wow. As far as we know, they are Islamic Arabs. Does anyone else have it? I don't know. He's asking, who are the modern-day Assyrians? Just in general, most of those people in the Middle East are related to the Arabs. Because Assyrians migrated. Okay, I found Assyrians, the largest group of Assyrians went to Russia. But there were also smaller groups of Assyrians who went to Germany. There's even a group of Assyrians in Iceland, little old innocent Iceland, you know. They've got some Assyrians in there, according to their symbols and legends. And Holland has a little bit of Assyrians in there. So the Assyrians went with those captives, you know. When Assyria was destroyed, not only the Israelites fled, the Assyrians themselves fled because the Babylonians were attacking them. And the Assyrians went up into, spread throughout Europe. And so I don't like to necessarily assume that they are ancient Assyrians, although they could be, have some ancient Assyrians with them, among them. But in general, they're sort of just Arabs, you know, strongly influenced by the Aramaeans, Arabs, you know, all the people that were there in the ancient Middle East and things like that.
Going back to the gentleman's question over there about Jonah.
Jonah.
Going to Nineveh. Now, the Ninevites repented.
Painted?
Repented.
Oh, repented. Repented, so they weren't destroyed. Yeah.
Because they repented.
Prophecies tell us to repent, don't they?
So they weren't under the law, they weren't Israelites. What did they repent of? Is there some connection here? Now we're talking about Assyrians.
Yeah.
It seems that there's some connection.
Yeah, I can only answer that by, it would take a while. But maybe very quickly I could say the Israelites... Let me just bring this map up here. I'm going to quit real soon because I can see people waving to me that my time is up. And now I've lost my map. Here we go. I'm about to quit. Okay. When in 1500 B.C., actually it was 1700 B.C., these Israelites went over here to Crete and then over here and founded Troy, okay? And then these people here were in trouble. They were shorter and darker race. They asked the Israelites, will you please help us against a satanic cult that lives over here in a city called Ur. Ur, very similar to the city of Ur down here, but so there were two Urs, actually. And he said yes, and he organized his forces, and they marched across here and destroyed. The leader of this cult was called the Dragon. And he destroyed the dragon. We don't know if that means he destroyed the person or the religion. But he did away with that religion. And then he marched on in and actually ruled the Middle East. His son did, especially. Sargon II was apparently his son. Or Sargon I was his son. And ruled the first. So he was an Israelite. So were there Israelites ruling in Assyria? And how? And to what extent and how much? And I'm not prepared to answer to what extent and how much, but I believe they actually had at least a brief influence, and maybe those people, see, in Assyria were either Israelites or close relatives. You know, Abraham's relatives, the Aramaeans ruled in there. The Aramaeans conquered that area for a while. The Elamites were Semitic too. They conquered that area for a while. But at least his son ruled there for a while, that whole Middle Eastern thing. And so maybe those were Israelites who were repenting. Not that all nations and all countries could repent, you know. I mean, they all had sort of a religion of some sort. But just the fact that Jonah was sent to them kind of makes you a little suspicious. Maybe they were Israelites, you know. Who knows? But that is a possible tie-in there out of that. And I'm studying that right now. The mythologies and the words that went into those languages at that date, I'm just writing my chapter on that now. It's hard to get back to that date and find all the words that fit. But it's a very exciting chapter that I'm writing right now, actually. And to tie that in with Sargon, he was his Dara. Dara, see, the guy that founded Troy was named Dara and Dardan, and the Dardanelles still have his name there. But his son, Gon, went in and became Prince Gon, or Sargon. Sar means prince. Prince Gon. Sargon, the first. Well, my time is up, so we will have a brief break and continue.
Okay, let's get it.
The identity of the Lost Ten Tribes is certainly a fascinating subject. I mean, the fact that there are so many people here today as testimony to that is something that many of us are interested in, and those even who haven't been interested before are probably getting more and more interested.
Is that on now? How much did you miss? All right, I'm glad you told me about that. Sorry about that. Okay, so I was just saying that the Israelites ruled throughout the Mediterranean area from 1700 down to 1500 B.C. Then Moses takes off, and even after Moses leads the Israelites back to the Promised Land, some Israelites there in the Middle East continued to dominate, known as Greeks and Trojans, throughout the Mediterranean area down until the time of the Trojan War in 1200 B.C. And even after that, they're still kind of ruling clear down until the 10 lost tribes disappear in 700 B.C. Some of them spread as far east as India, known as Aryans. Some of them spread throughout the Anatolia, that's Turkey area. Maybe I should put this map on just for a minute. They spread throughout the Turkey area here. Some of them came over to Greece, up in here to Thrace and so on. Some of them spread up into the Danube River area. Some of them, at the time of the Trojan War, some of them came over here and became the founders of Rome. Some of them took off in ships and came over here to Ireland. Now, I've studied a little bit about American Indian languages and the languages of the South Pacific and so on, and I keep noticing Hebrew in there. And what I found out is that at least among some in Mexico, that they took off at this date, this BDG shifts to PTK, all right, and went to Mexico where the Mayans and Toltecs were living. The Mayan and Toltec language, I was giving a lecture on this. It's not my specialty, so I was hesitant to say anything. But I looked at that Mayan language and the Toltec language of those Indians that live in Mexico and Central America, clear down in Central America. And I said, they have to be at least influenced by Israelites out of 1500 BC. And a man raised his hand. He was a scholar in ancient history of American Indians. And he said, well, yes. He says, the Toltecs have a legend that they escaped from Moses' wrath and fled. He was mad at them for worshiping the golden calf. You remember the story there. And they fled and drifted from continent to continent until they came to Mexico. And I hadn't even heard of that legend. I just said it based on the language influence. Not only does BDG shift to PDK, but when you shift it, it's Hebrew, okay? And they read the Popol Vuh, that's their holy text of the Mayans and Toltecs, okay? And so I was fascinated about that. Not that they look a lot like Israelites, but at least that they could have had, merged in or whatever, blended in with some indigenous people there. Then we jump down to 700 BC, and where do those Israelites go in 700 BC? Well, of course, we have the ones who are taken captive who end up going north of the Black Sea, some of them living there for 700 years, but some of them taking off right away to Scandinavia. And by the way, we can trace them, they're mound builders. Why they're mound builders, no one knows. They didn't build mounds in the Middle East normally, but they did sometimes. I've counted at least five or six references in the Old Testament to the fact that they did build mounds, but it wasn't normal way of burying their dead. But these people buried their dead. But there is one reference that gives me hope that this is an interpretation. Jeremiah says, I believe it's in 21:20, and Jeremiah says, Ephraim, I don't know if I can quote it exactly, but he paraphrased, he says, Ephraim, build up high heaps as waymarks. In other words, to let us know where you went, build up high heaps. And he did. They buried all their chieftains and kings and so on in high heaps. You can follow those high heaps. There are three routes. First ride off, they took off from the Black Sea where they were here, and they went up to Scandinavia. And the top of Scandinavia, and then they came down to southern Sweden, and there you can get up on a hill and look out and count 1,000 high heaps, burial chambers. And the ones they've opened up, they haven't opened them all up, but a few of them they have. They're multi-chambered, kind of reminding us of Abraham's multi-chambered burial cave. And they're also have ornaments and artifacts which the Russian archaeologists feel came from the Middle East, like from Israel. So it's not absolute proof, but it suggests that they could be Israelites. The other migration goes straight west, and those were the Celts going into Europe. And the third migration goes diagonally from here up to Denmark, and that's the people, Antenor, chief prince of Ephraim, his son Markomir, led a group in, and they became the forefathers of the Franks in Europe. Also then in 700 BC, where else did they go? Some of them went east over to east of the Caspian Sea here. They became known as, and they dropped down into India, Iran, Afghanistan, influenced the east. Okay, so my volume 2 will cover those when I write my book on that. So some of them did travel through Russia here. We expect to find some in Russia, and the Russian language does show some Hebrew influence. Okay, 700 BC. So mainly though, the two biggest, largest groups are the Germanic tribes in the north and the Celtic tribes in the west of Europe for 700 BC. Now, 600 BC. 600 B.C. is the Babylonian. The Babylonians attacked. And where did they go? Jeremiah went down into Egypt and then eventually came over here to Ireland. Most of the 600 B.C. Jews were taken into Babylonian captivity, and a lot of them stayed there. The ones who stayed, Cyrus not only had some of them return, he actually placed them. He says, I'll find you a home, and he took some of them over here into Persia and over here into Central Asia. So the Central Asia has incoming Israelites from the 10 lost tribes in 700 B.C. and also 600 B.C. Then I noticed, when I looked worldwide for some more influence, I noticed some influence in South American Indian languages. Different from Central America. South American Indian languages had a little of this P goes to F stuff, and S goes to SH, like Judah does. And among a few of the Indians there. Where else? What have I left out? Okay, that's 700 B.C. Then, 600 B.C. Then the time of Jesus. Where'd they go? How many of you remember? The Jews went primarily to Venice, Alps, Switzerland, and Benjamin went to Austria, but a lot came around here to England, okay? Glastonbury, England claims Jesus came there as a boy, and maybe later as a resurrected being. The what?
The Cathars.
Cathars? Oh, the Cathars. That's another story. Just briefly, during the Crusades, when, you know, on one of the Crusades, the Knights Templar went down the Middle East, and they came back with a lot of stuff. In fact, some people think they brought the heraldry back. You know, I don't think so, and I'm going to show you why I don't think so. But they did bring back a lot of information, and against the Catholic Church, and they actually bribed the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church came after them. They had to go underground, and they reemerged as Masons and Cathars, as far as we know. Okay, kind of a secret society.
The
Knights Templar didn't.
When the Inquisition
wiped out. Weren't they already gone underground at that time?
No, that
they were there. Yeah. I'm having a hard time remembering what I read about the Cathars. So I don't know. Does anyone know the answer to the Cathars? Who are they? They may have been. Some people just think they were Christians. Some Christians went up, and they're Christian Jews. But there's probably more to it than that, you know. So I don't know. I guess we'll have to look for that one. Oh, question clear back here. There's some English legends that say Jesus went there as a boy with his uncle Joseph. When he was a tin miner. Yeah.
Merchant,
yeah. And they think people got around a lot better with ships than we believe. Even clear back in the Phoenician days, they had ships, you know.
You mentioned about the Mexicans and their physiology. Sort of correspond with Israelites. Could they be part of the mixed multitude that were following Israel around and cleared out after the Golden Calf episode?
Could be. Maybe. But they have a legend that they are Israelites who fled when Moses got after them. So, you know, I don't know. According to the legend, they are Israelites, but yeah, they could be mixed.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps, yeah.
How do the Malaysians of Spain fit into it all? Are they...
The Malaysians of Spain?
Malaysians. M-I-L-A-S-I-A-N-S. I think they had a king, Milesius. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I thought you were going to ask me about the Basques. I have a better answer for the Basques, but I don't know for sure. We are going to get into Spain in the next lecture now. So I'm going to turn to heraldry. Now, just to remind us, how many tribes were there? 13, and then, but the 11 land tribes, but 13 tribes. In their birth order, we have Reuben is the oldest, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. But when they divided Joseph, Ephraim takes the 11th position, being the birthright son. And if you can see this, Ephraim stays in that 11th position where Joseph was. Benjamin stays 12, and Manasseh moves to 13th position. That is a theory, and it seems to be borne out by the symbols that we're going to be looking at as they spread out. The oldest born was Manasseh, and if you want to check on the where we get these symbols from, it's from the 49th chapter of Genesis. And you can read that when you have time. Basically, it says, though, see, these blessings are quite symbolic. You know, they mention Benjamin as a wolf. What kind of a blessing is that, you know? Except to give us a symbol maybe to look for. In fact, the very first verse of Genesis 49 says, this is regarding the last days. Whether it means last, sometimes last means later, you know, later time and period in history, but sometimes it means the very last days of the world. So it just says later days or last days, so we don't know for sure what it means, but it does seem to refer to a future time and not then. So Manasseh had a bundle of arrows and an olive branch. He actually had a bow as well. And it mentions his overly muscular arms. So I've actually found a heraldic symbol in Europe with overly muscular arms, pulling a bow, and you see the arrow, you know, perfect example of Manasseh. I'm not sure why Manasseh came up first. I was thinking I had, maybe I have these backwards. Let's see here. I do, they're backwards. So let me do Reuben. Reuben's the firstborn. Let's do Reuben. It mentions wavy water because he was morally wavy. Wouldn't you hate to have a moral sin and then have it written in the Bible for the whole world to read about? I've always felt sorry for Reuben because on his deathbed, he gave one of the most powerful speeches on morality that you'd ever want to read. So he did repent. Okay, but and then he's a man, and so the man is his symbol. And the wavy water. Those are two major symbols for Reuben. Next comes Simeon. Simeon is the one who was denied a land because he went over a castle wall and slew a man with a sword. Actually slew a lot of men with a sword. But his symbols became a castle or a castle wall and a sword. Okay, so we'll look for those in Europe. Judah. Symbol, it has a lion, it's mentioned three times. So we'll look for a lion in Europe. Dan's symbol is a horse and a snake. Horse and a snake. And the actual words are that a snake would hiss at the horse's heels and the horse would throw off its rider, and later he picks up an eagle as a symbol. Let's see. Naphtali could run so fast that he would not mash the grain. Sounds like a miracle. Is that possible miracles can happen? A lot of people reject that theory, but you know, when you think of some people, Jesus walked on water and stuff. This guy could run. That's the theory, but he could run as fast as a deer. That was his, you know, so a deer became his symbol. Asher, a covered goblet. It's called royal dainties. Anything royal, this covered goblet seems to represent the royalty. Royal dainties, great cooks, pastries, delicate white pastries. You find those in Europe, in some countries. I don't think any of Asher went to Germany. Just kidding. They went to Scandinavia, though. Those Danish pastries are so good. They make you go cross-eyed just to eat them. They're so rich. But in Germany, they measure their pastries by how heavy they are. I tease the Germans. I like German food, but I tease them about their pastries. Okay, Zebulun. A ship. Not just a ship. Artistically the same ship. You can trace it up through Europe. And the Bible says he would be by the be by the sea. He was not in the Middle East, but well, we don't think he was. Most maps don't put him in the. He may have been, but in the latter days, in the future days or whatever, in Europe, he would be. And I'll show you where he is. He is along the seaside. And of course, some people say, well, sure, if he's a fisherman, he's going to have a ship for a symbol. But it's artistically the same ship that goes up through Europe to the North Sea and the what? Yeah, that's true. Starts out in actually Amsterdam and goes across. Ephraim is mentioned, a bull, a unicorn, and a horn.
John Bull.
John Bull. I personally believe that it did not start out as a unicorn, as we know a unicorn. The word horse anciently meant large beast. It did not mean horse as we know it. So a large beast with a horn. Yeah. See, even hippopotamuses are called horse of the Nile. Okay. So what's a large horn with one horn? Or a large beast with one horn? It's a rhino. And when the Israelites lived in Egypt, they knew what that was. But when they went back to the Middle East, I think they forgot what horse meant. A horse was just large beast. And as horse took on the meaning of horse, they started picturing a horse with one horn. And then, since there isn't such a thing, they called it a mythological animal. But I believe, personally, it was the rhino, the rhinoceros.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's even translated that way in some of the earliest Bibles, the Catholic Bible and the Greek Bible. Benjamin, a wolf. Okay, we'll trace the wolf. The wolf goes into Norway and Iceland. That's not going to work. Now, when the Israelites camped in the wilderness, they camped with the Ark of the Covenant in the middle and the tabernacle, surrounded by the priests. Outside of the priests, there are these four camps of Israelites, three on each side. And a heraldic symbol identified them. Now that heraldic symbol, let me just put this up here for a minute. The heraldic symbol was the leading, based on the leading camp. Like the leading camp of Judah took the law. Took Judah, the leading camp of Reuben took the Reuben's sign of a man, and Ephraim took the bull. All of North Israel wouldn't accept that bull as a symbol. They took the unicorn as their symbol because the bull reminded them of the golden calf, okay, which Ephraim made them worship in the early days. But Dan did not take his own symbol. He took the ancient symbol of the eagle, which was an ancient symbol for Israel. And he took that symbol and made it his camp symbol. So when we see an eagle, we have to decide, is that ancient Israel symbol or is that a Dan symbol? Kind of hard to tell. But let me just finish now. So in this way they were camped, there were these four camp symbols. And then behind that, we have symbols for each of these tribes. Can you imagine a child wandering off and there's a million Israelites there or more, and he's trying to find his own tent? Well, they put up their flags and their signs and their, you know, they could find their way home. Judah, actually, if you read very closely, Numbers chapter 2, Judah should not be here, he should be here. Issachar is next. So it goes Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. So this artist's point of view is not exactly right with Numbers chapter 2. But in a way, it's kind of generally right. Now, Ezekiel and John the Revelator got to look into heaven and see what heaven was like. You remember that verse? And both of them described it the same way. They said there's the throne of God in the center. Here we have the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. Outside of the throne of God, there were 24 elders. And that's symbolized here by the Levites tribe. Outside of that, it says there were four beasts. And then it names the beasts. The beasts were those four beasts in heaven. What I'm proposing is not that heaven looks like the wilderness camp, but rather the wilderness camp was made to look like heaven. Moses made it that way so that it would be represent God's people.
The cherubim have four faces, each one in your picture.
Yeah, another example of that. Good, thanks. So the four beasts are a lion, an eagle, a man. I'm not sure whether they call a man a beast, but another translation for beast is images or
living creatures,
things like that. The only one that differs is one of them calls this a calf and one calls it an ox. So the bull, ox, and calf, they're all symbols for Ephraim. Oh, and then let me quite finish that little description here. And then it says that in heaven, outside of the four beasts, beyond the four beasts, were 10,000 times 10,000 angels. And I think that's symbolic of all the Israelites that surrounded that camp in Israel. Okay, now, on the, even before we get to heraldry, is that in backwards or whatever? The crown of this is Edward's, St. Edward's crown, but the other earlier crowns were based. Many of them were based on the same pattern. And Charlemagne in Europe, his talisman that hung here, same thing. 16 stones, four of them large. See, this is a large stone. Four large stones, like the four beasts in the wilderness, and then in between, three little stones representing the three camps of Israel. Okay, under the sea of glass, the baptismal font in Solomon's temple, they also had 12, had 12 oxen, Ephraim's symbol. And the throne in Judah had 12 lions, so that 12 kept showing up. Well, as the ancient Israelites, they kept their, kind of like keeping their genealogy, they kept track of who their people were with these symbols. And when someone would get married, they'd take two symbols, the lion and the unicorn would marry, and so they put both of them on the shield.
Another thing in numerics, that 12 tribes of Israel, 12 pence in a shilling, 12 inches in a foot. And
right.
Of course, modernly, we've moved away out of metric system.
Most of Europe's moved away, but England and America sort of kept that, haven't they?
I think the United States has said, no, stick it where it's staying.
The United States stuck with the 12.
Doesn't they go back to Egypt and 5, measurement of 5?
Yeah, because who taught the Egyptians? Abraham. Look at this shield. 943 symbols. They were trying to keep track of every one of their relatives. After a while, they just said, let's just keep track two or three back. So you end up with four, five, six symbols on a shield. You don't usually end up with this many. But here's just an example. This is in the 900s. Some people say, in the Crusades, they brought these symbols back from. That's why they all look like Israel symbols in Europe. But this goes back to beyond the Crusades, 900. And I've got some other things in here that go back to 500 AD, way before the Crusades. Okay, so I don't think they go back to the Crusades. Now, let's see if you can remember who had the unicorn. Ephraim had the unicorn. That's true. Who has the unicorn today? Britain. Okay. Lion and the unicorn, right? Okay. Not only is this heraldic symbol have a unicorn, but it also has a horn, which is also Ephraim's symbol, doubling up there. So when you start seeing the duplication, it kind of strengthens the evidence that these are Israel symbols. Unicorn here, three unicorns. The horns mentioned three times, so a horn became a symbol. See this symbol down here? This is my symbol. Well, you know what? We all have several symbols. This is one of my symbols on one of my lines, okay? Going back, is this shield with three horns on it. Horns over here. Horns, okay? Oh, I didn't mention. Oh, look at this. That is not a castle. That is a well. One of the tribes had a symbol of a well, and that is Joseph. Before it's divided into Benjamin and into Manasseh and Ephraim, he had a well, and that is a well. His branches were supposed to run over the wall, and some people interpret that to mean cross the ocean, okay, to the Americas. A lion. Whose symbol was a lion? Judah. Whose symbol was wavy water? Reuben. So look here, this marriage. Somebody from Reuben married somebody from Ephraim, okay? So, now look at this, the way they divided this. This is a cross. The cross was the ancient symbol of Israel. And now later people had a cross, but probably because they were Israelites. But, you know, sometimes we say the cross is St. Patrick, cross is St. Edward, cross is this, and that, you know, cross of Andrew's cross and things. But they had those crosses based on the fact that who they were trying to identify themselves with, too. Who was the man? Reuben. Now, quite often you'll have holding, the common people are represented by whoever holds the shield. The shield represents the leadership of the country and the founders of the country. And then quite often above that, they'll stick a symbol which represents the kingly line, which may not even represent the people at all. Okay, so we'll see that. Oh, I just wanted to mention these crosses here. Now, by the way, the goat, the ram. The ram was a symbol of Israel. Goes clear back to Abraham. Okay. There's a play on words. See, the goat is the same word as Gad. So we don't know if it's Gad's people. But it's also an ancient word for God. You know, one of their words for God was Lord in North Israel. It wasn't in South Israel. But in North Israel, they had a word. There's at least five or six different words for Lord. Okay, but one of them was God. But it's the same root as goat, and it's the same root as good. So good, God, and goat. So this is a play on words. So when you see this, they were originally, I don't know about later, but initially consciously aware of the fact that the goat symbolized God's people, and perhaps Gad's people too. But Gad didn't have a goat. Gad's symbol was not a goat. Okay. And then, oh, this symbol up here, the cross. Do you remember in the 48th chapter of Genesis, Israel crosses his arms and gives the birthright to Ephraim instead of Manasseh. And that, of course, Ephraim picked up on that. That becomes a symbol, okay? Even though we call it Andrew's cross, it goes clear back. And that's a symbol for Ephraim. Let's see if you can remember these. Who's had the horse? Dan had the horse. Dan had the horse. Dan had the snake. And look at this. Here we got two of Dan's symbols in the same heraldic symbol. The snake and the horse. The snake plays an important role in early American U.S. history. It's the people who started the Revolutionary War had the snake as their symbol. So we think there was a contingent of Dan, at least, among the Americans. So Dan the horse here, Dan, these horses. When Dan went to Ireland, they painted horses on the cliffs and walls of the mountains. And look, what's this? A lion, a horse, an eagle, a castle. Who's the castle? Simeon.
Is that one on the right, on the bottom left? A griffin? No, on the shield.
The here?
Isn't that a griffin and not a lion?
There's no wing. I don't know. I think this is a lion, but we will come to a griffin in a minute, and then we can maybe discuss that some more. The griffin appears to have been the symbol of Assyria, and every once in a while I see that. Yeah. Okay, here you see some Reuben. Look at this man up here. Almost looks like a knight. See, I think Reuben's symbol of the knight kind of influenced the symbol of the knight. And here's the fleur-de-lis, a Christian symbol standing for the Trinity. Fleur-de-lis, right. There's the castle in the background. The orb became sort of a Christian symbol. But the cross on the orb, the cross was an ancient symbol of Israel. It was a spiritual symbol. It stood for man's eternal progress. And this one line stands for a man's life. And then this is God descending. And when they meet, you got to be ready. You know, they talked about the second coming. You know, we talk about the second coming of Christ. Well, there's two meanings to that. Secretly, back in ancient Israel, meaning he would not only come to the world, but he would come to you personally, and that might be even more important than when he comes to the world. Okay, and it'll be glorious. You talk about the glorious coming of Christ, it might be to you personally. And the Israelites constantly kept that in mind with this cross. It was not a Christian cross, but longer. It was straight. But that symbol, it kept them reminded always that they had to be ready for if God ever came to them, so that they would be ready. Down here you got Manasseh. Here you get wavy water from Reuben. Am I leaving anything out? Lion, again up here, wavy water. So somebody from Judah married someone from Reuben, okay? And you get that kind of stuff. This hand up here is bright red. There were two lines of Judah going down. One's Zerah and one's Perez. Perez produced the kingly line, but Zerah migrated. He's the guy who went over and founded Troy. And his symbol was a red hand and a red cross and a red lion. What? Red ribbon? Right, put out his hand, they tied a red cord around it and said, this one came out first, but he didn't come out first. Pull his hand back in, the other one was born first. So there's a contention over the birthright there. Yeah, that's right. And you saw the red ribbon there under his hand. We'll see another one of those or I'd go back. Now the ship, who's the ship belong to? Zebulun had the ship, okay. Artistically the same ship, look at that. You know, artistically the same ship. The sails look a little different and stuff, but now, I didn't earlier on, I didn't mention that which tribe had the tent. That's Gad. Now, if you draw a tent, let me just draw a tent over here, and you can recognize quickly what his. This is a tent, and this is the door of the tent. And what have you got? The chevron symbol, right down here. The more I think about it, the more I've become convinced that is the symbol of Gad. Gad's other symbol was a donkey, commonly called a jackass. And for some reason, he didn't want to use that symbol in Europe. I don't know if he got teased, embarrassed. It became a cuss word. It's the number one cuss word in Germany. So, you know, the donkey faded out. I've only been able to find two donkeys in all of Europe. But this tent, his other symbol, is quite found quite a bit. Okay. Now, with an arm, mighty arm, Simeon went over the castle wall and slew a man with the sword. Look at this arm reaching over with holding a sword, reaching over the castle wall. I think that is very descriptive of Simeon going over the castle wall. Okay, here's the castle here too. Here we get lions. The ship of Zebulun, a fish also became a symbol of Zebulun. And what else do you see here? The eagle of Israel, it could be, though, the Dan's camp symbol. It's hard to tell. And the bull. Who's the bull? Ephraim. Here's Reuben. This is a bull of Ephraim. And a deer of Naphtali. Okay? Naphtali. This is Cumberland. A bull, again. Sometimes you'll see numbers are important. They're hard to figure out because there was a birth order number and there was also a camp marching order. And so sometimes it matches one and sometimes it matches the other. So I haven't made a big deal out of it, although occasionally it's kind of fun to point out that was the birth marching order of one of the tribes or the birth order. Castle wall again of Simeon, Reuben. Look at all these. A deer of who? Naphtali. Look at the, how many are there? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Is that 8?
Yep.
See, Reuben was not the 8th in birth order. I don't think he was the 8th in marching order either. So the numbers are a little bit hard to add up. But there's the snake of Dan. And, of course, the bull, you know, the headdress and so on, and the symbol, John Bull, of the English and the Ephraim.
It's interesting the eagle was used a lot, like the United States have an eagle on their crest.
It's used a lot, and that's why I think it's more than just Dan. Mm-hmm.
The Russians had back-to-back eagles. I think even the Royal German family had twin eagles too.
motive. It's amazing. And the Romans on their standards. The Germans in World War II on their standards. It's amazing how...
Poland had an eagle. Germany had an eagle. U.S. had an eagle.
Amazing how many times...
Yeah. And some of them split in half to get the double eagle. And that may go back to other things, but at least a split in the kingdom, you know. Now this is a typical thing for Dan. It says, the snake would hiss at the horse's hoofs. Isn't that descriptive?
Yeah.
And then the rider would fall off. But look, Dan later took on the eagle as a symbol. So there's two eagles flying overhead, the snake, the horse, and so on. Now, you count the 10, whatever it is here on his shield, and that's his marching order, not his birth order, so of Dan. So that's kind of interesting. What else do we have here? Anything else that's new? Oh, U.S. symbols here. Dan played a role in our Revolutionary War. Okay, and here we have the snakes of Dan. Reuben, club of Reuben. The club seems to symbolize power or something like that, majesty or whatever. He would... something like that. I don't know about majesty, but strength at least. Quite a few Simeon symbols. Look at this big cross here. See, they'll use symbols sometimes to divide the shield. And here they've used the cross of Ephraim, okay, the Andrew's cross. Uh-huh. And you can see other things. There's Andrew's cross again down there. Oh, here's the red hand. If this were in color, you'd see that this hand is red. And that's the Zara line. That went up to Ireland. North Ireland. North Ireland has the red hand, the red cross, and the red lion. Here we see the horses down below here, painted on the walls of Ireland. Okay, so represent their people. Here we have the cross, quartering this the horses here, so the marriage perhaps between Ephraim and Dan. Dan's horses. The tent of Gad. Good. Tent of Gad. Some more. I've tried to collect on this one. Yeah, it's just a hodgepodge, I guess. You see quite a few castles. Lions of Judah. The ship of Zebulun. Bull of Ephraim. Lion down here of Judah. This is a red lion. Oh, the stars and moon. That is another symbol for Issachar. He's pretty hard to find in Europe. Issachar. Issachar. Some people say Issachar. You what?
Tomato.
Tomato and tomato? Issachar. It's fine to say Issachar. I can adapt to that just fine. But he had the stars and moon. And that shows up quite often. When the Goths attacked Rome, 476 AD, and destroyed Rome, they were led by a people called the Scyri. You take out the unstressed vowels of Issachar, and you've got Scyri. Okay. Now I'm going to have to kind of rush a little. I think we're out of time. But any symbols there you don't know? This is Asher for the covered goblets. You find those mostly in France and Italy. A few in Denmark, and spread throughout Britain a little bit, sparsely. Another covered goblet there, marriage into this, maybe a symbol of Dan. Now look at this tent. See, the overall symbol of a tent is Gad. But look, they found some furs or something that looked like tents. Okay? So they used different things to represent their, make it look like their symbols. So, trailing along here, I'm not sure. A few more, and some of them we've seen before. Anything, see anything new there? Okay. Star of David plays a role. They even laid out some cities in the six-pointed star shape, especially in the Netherlands. So, Star of David, some people call it Star of Solomon. And look at these four stars. Okay, Judah was four stars, but... And look, those are six-pointed stars, okay? And Judah had six-pointed stars, but Judah was the fourth tribe in birth order, so four stars that way. Look at this cross of Israel, okay? Ancient cross of Israel, and the sword of Simeon. Okay, more six-pointed stars here. Okay, six-pointed stars. here's six-pointed stars, but look, it's combined with the moon. And when that happens, then that's talking about Issachar. Okay. Issachar and Judah, perhaps, combined. The you've seen the British Royal Arms, I'm sure. Very beautiful in color. I think I have this one in color in a minute. I didn't dare show the colored ones first, or it'd make these look too drab. But here you have the unicorn and the lion. Whereas Ephraim, you know, the northern ten tribes had been an enemy to Judah all during those years, but when they got to Europe, there seemed to be a pact, a bond between them in England. And so here we see British, what is this, Holland? Yeah, Belgium? Oh, Belgium, okay. Lion, okay, and down here we have the red lions and tawny lions. Tawny was the Zeraline they intermarried there. And okay, here we have some more, the Netherlands. Look at the city of Horn, okay, they're using their symbol to name their city. Horn was a symbol of Ephraim, and they've got the horn as their symbol, and they call the city Horn. And they've got both a lion and a unicorn as a symbol. This symbol here goes back to about 500, at least back to 500 AD. So the unicorn, they used to find that on ships and things like that. It goes way back. So a lot of the symbols are older than the Crusades. Now here's the ship of Zebulon, first seen in Amsterdam. And it says his borders would stretch unto Zidon. And Zidon was the capital of Phoenicia. And I've traced the Phoenicians, and they went to Estonia. Sidon, the D shifts to a T, and you got Estone. Sidon, Estone. That's where the Phoenicians, some of the Phoenicians settled, was in Estonia. Their language is different. They actually took Syrians up there and dropped the Syrians off in Finland. And that's why their language is different, too. They're Syrians. Greece has quite a bit of Reuben in it, but also mostly Dan, as from other symbols. And this down here is Greece, I believe. No, Luxembourg. Kind of look alike, though, don't they? Luxembourg has two colors of lions, red and tawny, Zerah and Pharez. Just got a few more. Now, I didn't talk about Levi's symbols, but the Levi breastplate had 12 stones in it, and that became the symbol for the tribe of Levi. Levi was in the administrative center of Jerusalem, and for priesthood purposes, and he becomes in the administrative center of London, which is Westminster, and this is the symbol of Westminster. It became a portcullis symbol, but you see, it's got the chains around it like the priest wore. It's got the 12 places here, and anciently they found it. It didn't always have these portcullis spikes at the bottom. There's what?
The coat of arms.
Really? You know, I wish I could go in. I wish we had time. If you take a look at all of the coats of arms of Australia, and I've done the same thing with the 50 states of the United States, they all represent all those tribes. You know, it's just so interesting to study that. So, thank you. I wanted to show, here it is next. Canada, the symbol of Canada doesn't have those spikes at the bottom, and the symbol of Canada today is just the maple leaf, but look at the ancient original symbol of Canada has those four windows. That is the breastplate, you know, so it's possible that at least a contingent of Levites went to Canada. And then down below is the Spanish symbol. You've got red lions, orange, yellow lions, you've got fleur-de-lis here, you've got a lot of simian. The Castile, the main influential language group in Spain was the Castilians, meaning the castle people. Okay, Simeon. If this were in color, you would see that this is a red hand, a red cross, a red lion, and here's Naphtali, a deer from Naphtali. They went up to northern Ireland. Okay, look at the harp of David. It becomes a symbol for some of his family. This is a red cross here as well. So you see a lot of Zerah, Judah, going up into North Ireland. Here's a red lion, two unicorns. This is Scottish, yeah. And Scotland had two unicorns, so that must be predominantly, at least, Ephraim there. And then superimposed over here is the royal Judah line coming in. Yeah, uh-huh. Another Ephraim symbol. Now, the Israelites went to Europe. I should tell you this before I quit for sure. The Israelites went to Europe. Ephraim came in, and he had been the ruler of the 10 northern tribes. They didn't argue. They made him the ruler in Europe. He split into three groups. One group, calling themselves the Swari, it's a word for bull. Okay, it's a word for black bull. He went to conquer Scandinavia. Sverg is the modern word for Sweden. That's related to that word Swari. And then the Anglo, the word for bull, another word for bull is Egil, becomes the English, and he conquers Britain. And the third group of Ephraim is the Franks. So he conquered the continental mainland of Europe. So there's Ephraim showing his leadership as he did in the Middle East, ruling all of Europe. Then Judah came in. Judah says, hey, we have the birthright. We have the scepter. See, and Ephraim didn't have to contend with that in the Middle East, but he did in Europe, and so he says, okay. So to not lose the throne, the Ephraim rulers of Europe hurried and married Jewish princesses. So all of that royal line in Europe, his marriage, it was all Ephraim, but they hurried and married all Jewish princesses so they could stay on the throne. And so it's a mixture of blood between Jewish, and I think those are true Jews, and Ephraim. The cross ends up being on some of the symbols of, in early England. That's the six-pointed star thing. I think most of this other stuff I can sort of skip. I believe we've seen it. There's the six-pointed Dokkum, city in Holland that has done a six-pointed star thing. Now, the Jews don't like us saying that these symbols in Israel are Israelite symbols. And their excuse was, they have never found an eagle in upright position like we see in Europe. Therefore, they can't be the same eagles. About a month after they said that, they found this thing in the Middle East, obviously Jewish, six-pointed star, eagles in an upright position holding the Ten Commandments. So, they can't, you know what? Yeah, what did I say? I'm sorry. Lions of Judah. And they were saying that the lion in Europe can't be the lion in Judah because of the upright position. This little column here of wolves, okay, they built that in Norway. But then when the Normans came down to France and the other Benjaminites went over to Iceland, maybe all of Benjamin left. We're not sure. Maybe all of Benjamin left because they tore this column down. Oh, I was going to show you the scone. There it is, right there. Okay, here's the throne. I got to see this. Touch this rock here. Supposedly the stone of scone from Israel.
Following through from what you said, it appears to me that what you're having to fight is that those so-called lost tribes regain their, or maintain their identity as those tribes.
For a long time.
For a long enough time in history that the heraldic symbols were already extant.
Yeah.
And after they forgot the identity,
yeah. Now, it's possible they kept using the symbols even after they lost their identity. But I think they did keep their identity for a long time. Was it 1,000 or 1,300? Maybe some of you know this story. The Queen of England asked for a count. We hear rumors of lost tribes. All those who can identify themselves as lost tribes, please make yourself known. And some representatives from Afghanistan went up and said, we are the lost tribes, and somebody else came up from different countries saying, we are. They still knew they were members of the lost tribes in 1000 AD. I think it was 1000 AD. So they kept their identity quite a while. Not all of them kept it that long, but some of them did. Look here in Iceland. What are the four camp symbols? A man, an eagle, a bull. Three of the four camps are represented in Iceland. What's this?
Griffin.
Assyria's griffin. A little contingent of Assyria. Must have gone to Iceland. That's all we can assume from that. Iceland, now, by the way, this is the same as the eagle. This is actually a hawk or a falcon. I think it's a falcon. But the original word was not eagle. It was bird of prey. So, they could choose any bird of prey and... Okay. Now, I just want to show an interesting thing. S-O-R-A is the word for bull in North in Israel. And the North Israelites shifted the S to what? S-T. O-S-K. Here you see S-T. Stora means bull kingdom weapons. You know, what do we say? Not weapons, but symbols. Okay, they call them weapons. Vapnet, you know. So this Rix is the kingdom of the Stora, the kingdom of the bulls. That's what they were calling Sweden because Ephraim settled it with the bull symbol. Kingdom of the bulls. And guess what they called their states? The little bulls in the plural. These are the little bulls. The plural of this is what's strange is this word has a very strange plural in Hebrew. It goes from S-O-R, and then in North Israel, S-T-O-R-A, Stora, to S-W. This O is actually, it's a vowel, but it can be a consonant. When it's a consonant, it's a W. So it goes to a W or a V here. W and V were the same letter. It goes to S-W-A-R-A, Svara, or Svarim in Hebrew, Svarim. This goes to Svariga. That is the plural for Stora. And it's such an unusual plural that to see that up there, I was really pleased when I saw that. And most of the Israelites, when they settled, they insisted on founding their country with 12 colonies or 12 major cities. Okay? If they needed more than that, they doubled it. This is 24. And look at all the Israel symbols that are among them. You know, all but one or two. You know, the moose. The moose might be a form of deer, I don't know, if they're considering that a deer. But, you know, most of these are Israel symbols. I don't know what this is over here. Okay? But most of these you'll recognize as Israel symbols. And this is the word plural for bulls, and black bulls, in fact. Black bulls, because Ephraim's color was black. Now, one more. Holland does the same. Oh, Scotland does it. Scotland founds it with 12. Germany founds it with 12. Most of those countries founded their countries with 12 cities or colonies. Look here. In the Netherlands, 12. Now, what we've got here is 12 states and the capital of each state. So that's why we have, see the lines? They still, because of the line, we still have 12 groups, is what we've got. And it's the state and the capital city in each instance. And then again, you see the Israel symbols again, okay? So they maintain that 12 all the time. It's an important thing to maintain 12 or 24, and in the United States went to 48, being so large. Ephraim? Well, Manasseh had these symbols here. Joseph had the symbols of wheat and the well. There were children from Joseph other than Ephraim and Manasseh. It just mentions other children. Now, the United States symbols, you've probably seen these. The United States insisted on 13. Why? Because even though most of them thought of 12, that leaves out Manasseh, who is the 13th tribe. And so the United States and Brazil both insisted on founding their countries with 13 colonies. And so we get 13 moons, 13 stars, 13 arrows, 13 olives. Here we got either 48 or 50. I'm not sure how old this seal is. Probably 50. You get the 13, okay? 13 stripes. Down here, you get some more Israel symbols. You've got 13 stars here in the shape of a Star of David. You've got clouds. See, the clouds represented the Israelites were led in the wilderness by clouds by day, fire by night. Here's the fire in here. And E Pluribus Unum has 13 letters, and so on. I'm not sure why nine. Nine is Dan's symbol, and Dan does seem to play a predominant role. And maybe that's why. We have nine judges, too, so I'm not sure. But
there was a lot of Irish settled in Australia.
Yeah, in the early days. We're about done. I bet you're getting tired. My time's probably up. Is my time up? Oh, my time's up. Holy smokes. Okay. Anything that's new for you? Okay. I think time's up then. Maybe if I can just summarize, I don't even know if I have time for questions, but I can always ask questions afterwards if any of you have questions afterwards. It's been a joy for me to study this. I get to combine my profession, where I study linguistics, with my hobby to follow Israelites. And from a religious point of view, I get to mix, you know, do my religion. I mean, I have three reasons to study the lost tribes. And you know, there's a little biblical verse that says Elijah would return and bring back, that the spirit of Elijah would come, which would turn the hearts of the children to their fathers. And here's how I kind of interpret that, at least partially. When we look for our ancestors, whether you do it in genealogy to find your immediate ancestors, my brother's a specialist on that, or whether you go way back and try to find the lost tribes as more distant ancestors, I think we find part of ourselves because we find our identity. And when you know where you came from, it gives meaning, you know, more meaning to your life and perhaps more direction to your life. You know what I mean? And so I think there's a spiritual purpose in this search for our ancestors, and I think there's a lot of good reasons to find it, not just a linguistic reason or a, you know, whatever. There's a lot of good reasons, but I find the most fulfilling, perhaps, in the spiritual thing of Elijah getting us to children to search for their fathers and turn their hearts to their fathers. And so I've been happy to be here. You've been a great audience. Thank you very much. I'll be here for questions. Do you want me to take questions, answer questions publicly, or just one at a time? However, what do you think? We about done? Okay, we'll just do. Thank you. Thank you.
Can I just ask where the French got the fleur-de-lis?
I don't. It's a Christian symbol. It stands for the Trinity, or, you know, Father, Son, Holy Ghost type thing. It's a. I don't know for sure.
Hebrew.
Yeah. No, I don't think it goes back to an Israel symbol. But that doesn't mean it's not Israelites, you know, Israelites, but Christian Israelites.
Can I answer that?
Oh, yeah.